Those singed by the fire become burnt children, eternal orphans in empires of illusion. Dying civilizations make war on independent intellectual inquiry, art and culture, on the burnt children. The masters of the corporate state do not want us to peer into the pit or heed the cries of those who have seen what awaits us. The corporate state rather feeds the thirst for illusion, happiness, and hope. It peddles the fantasy of endless material progress. It insists, and this is the argument of globalization, that our voyage is unalterable, decreed by natural law. It is part of the march of human progress, and those who challenge this myth are heretics. Clive Hamilton, in his book Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change, describes a kind of dark relief that comes from accepting that catastrophic climate change is virtually certain. This obliteration of false hopes, he says, requires an intellectual knowledge and an emotional knowledge. The first is attainable, the second, because it means those we love, including our children, will face insecurity, misery, and suffering within a few decades, if not a few years, is much harder to acquire. To emotionally accept impending disaster, to attain the gut-level understanding that the power elite will not respond rationally to collapse, is as difficult to accept as our own mortality. The most daunting existential struggle of our time is to ingest this awful truth intellectually and emotionally, and yet rise up to resist the corporate forces that are destroying us. The human species, led by white Europeans and Euro-Americans, has been on a 500-year-long planet-wide rampage of conquering, plundering, looting, exploiting, and polluting the earth, as well as killing the indigenous communities that stood in the way. But the game is up. The technological and scientific forces that created a life of unparalleled luxury as well as unrivaled military and economic power for a small global elite are the forces that now doom us. The capitalist quest for ceaseless economic expansion has become a curse, a death sentence. But even as our economic and environmental systems unravel, after the hottest year in the contiguous 48 states since record-keeping began 107 years ago, we lack the vision and the courage to shut down the engines of global capitalism. Complex civilizations, as many anthropologists have observed, have a habit of ultimately destroying themselves. Joseph Tainter, in The Collapse of Complex Societies, Charles Redman, in Human Impact on Ancient Environments, and Ronald Wright, in A Short History of Progress, have laid out the familiar patterns that lead to systems breakdown. The difference is that when we go down this time, the whole planet will go with us. There will, with this final collapse, be no new lands to exploit, no new civilizations to conquer, no new peoples to subjugate, no new resources to plunder. Collapse occurs in complex societies not long after they reach their period of greatest power and prosperity. One of the most pathetic aspects of human history is that every civilization expresses itself most pretentiously, compounds its partial and universal values most convincingly, and claims immortality for its finite existence at the very moment when the decay which leads to death has already begun, Reinhold Niebuhr wrote. The ancient Mayan, the Sumerians of what is now southern Iraq, ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, even Easter Island, were destroyed by the mechanisms that once made them prosper. The novel ways these civilizations found to exploit the environment, such as the invention of irrigation systems, eventually created disastrous, unforeseen complications. Ronald Wright, in A Short History of Progress, calls this the progress trap. The Industrial Revolution created technological civilizations of such complexity and such dependence on ceaseless exploitation, Wright notes, that we do not know how to make do with less or reduce our demands on nature. We know only how to service and maintain a system that is now killing us. This is the evolutionary history of the human race. As the collapse becomes increasingly palpable, if human history is any guide, we, like past societies in distress, will see many retreat into what anthropologists call crisis cults. The powerlessness felt in the face of ecological and economic chaos will unleash further collective delusions, a belief, for example, that God or gods will come back to earth and save us. The Christian right embodies the escapism of crisis cults. These cults will perform absurd rituals, in our case probably Christian, to make it all go away. Believers will be entranced by magical thinking. Our bankers, corporate boards, politicians, television personalities, and generals hold up seductive images of unrivaled wealth and power. Like Ahab and his crew, these images spur us towards self-annihilation. All my means are sane, Ahab says, my motive and my object mad. Melville, who had been a sailor on clipper ships and whalers, was aware that the wealth of industrialized societies was violently seized from the wretched of the earth. All the authority figures on the ship are white men, Ahab, Starbuck, Flask, and Stubb. The hard, dirty work, from harpooning to gutting the carcasses of whales, is the task of the poor, mostly men of color. Melville saw how European plundering of indigenous cultures from the 16th to the 19th century, coupled with the use of African slaves as a workforce to replace the natives, enriched Europe and the United States. The Spanish conquest of the Americas set in motion 5 centuries of reckless economic and environmental plunder. Karl Marx and Adam Smith each attributed the huge influx of wealth from the Americas as having been made possible by the Industrial Revolution and modern capitalism. The Industrial Revolution equipped technologically advanced states with refined weapon systems, turning us into the most efficient killers on the planet. Ahab, when he first appears on the quarterdeck, after being in his captain for the first few days of the voyage, holds up a doubloon, an extravagant gold coin, and promises it to the crew member who first spots the white whale. He knows that the permanent constitutional condition of the manufactured man is sordidness, and he plays to this sordidness. The whale becomes, like everything in the capitalist world, a commodity, a source of personal profit, a murderous greed, one that Starbuck denounces as blasphemous, immediately grips the crew. Ahab's obsession infects the ship. Ahab conducts a dark mass, a Eucharist of violence and blood on the deck. He orders the crew to circle around him. He makes them drink from a flagon that is passed from man to man, filled with draughts hot as Satan's hoof. Ahab tells the harpooners to cross their lances before him. The captain grasps the harpoons and anoints the ship's harpooners, Queequeg, Tashtego, and Dagu, his 3 pagan kinsmen. He orders them to detach the iron sections of their harpoons and fill the sockets with the fiery waters from the pewter. Drink, ye harpooners, drink and swear, ye men that man the deathful whaleboat's crew. Death to Moby Dick. God hunt us all if we do not hunt Moby Dick to his death. And with the crew bonded to him in his infernal quest, he knows that Starbuck is helpless amid the general hurricane. Starbuck now is mine, Ahab says. Cannot oppose me now without rebellion. The honest eye of Starbuck, Melville writes, fell downward. The ship, described by Melville as a hearse, was painted black. It was adorned with gruesome trophies of the hunt, festooned with the huge teeth and bones of sperm whales. It was, Melville writes, a cannibal of a craft, tricking herself forth in the chaste bones of her enemies. The fires used to melt the whale blubber at night turned the Pequod into a red hell. And we live now on our own hearse, our own raging fires, leaping up from our oil refineries and the explosions of our ordnance across the Middle East, bespeak our lust for blood and profit. And in our mad pursuit, we ignore the suffering of those who impede our hunt, just as Ahab does when he refuses to help the captain of a passing ship who is frantically searching for his son who has fallen overboard. Ahab is not solely reliant on the heated rhetoric of persuasion. He oversees a terrifying internal security force on the ship, the five dusky phantoms that seem fresh formed out of air. Ahab's secret private whaleboat crew, his private mercenaries, keeps the rest of the ship in abject submission. The art of propaganda and the use of brutal coercion and fear are the familiar tools of tyranny. And our lives are as circumscribed as the lives of the crew on Melville's ship. The novel, in essence, is the chronicle of the last days of a civilization. And yet Ahab is no simple tyrant. Melville, at the end of the novel, gives us two glimpses into the internal battle between Ahab's maniacal hubris and his humanity. Ahab, too, has a yearning for love. He harbors regrets over his deformed life. The black cabin boy, Pip, is the only crew member who evokes any tenderness in the captain. Ahab is aware of this tenderness. He fears its power. Pip functions as the fool did in Shakespeare's King Lear. Ahab warns Pip of Ahab. "Lad, lad," says Ahab, "I tell thee, thou must not follow Ahab now. The hour is coming when Ahab would not scare thee from him, yet would not have thee by him." A few pages later, untottering Ahab stood forth in the clearness of the morn, lifting his splintered helmet of a brow to the fair girl's forehead of heaven. From beneath his slouched hat, Ahab dropped a tear into the sea. Nor did all the Pacific contain such wealth as that one wee drop. Starbuck approaches him. Ahab, for the only time in the book, is vulnerable. He speaks to Starbuck of his 40 years on the pitiless sea, the desolation of solitude it has been. Why this strife of the chase? Why weary and palsy the arm at the oar, and the iron and the lance? How the richer or better is Ahab now? He thinks of his young wife. "I widowed that poor girl when I married her," Starbuck, and of his little boy. About this time, yes, it is his noon nap now, the boy vivaciously wakes, sits up in bed, and his mother tells him of me, of cannibal old me, how I am abroad upon the deep, but will yet come back to dance with him again. Ahab's thirst for dominance, vengeance, and destruction, however, overpowers these faint regrets of lost love and thwarted compassion. Hatred wins. "What is it?" Ahab finally asks. "What nameless, inscrutable, unearthly thing is it? What cozening hidden lord and master and cruel, remorseless emperor commands me that against all natural lovings and longings, I so keep pushing and crowding and jamming myself on all the time?" Melville knew that physical courage and moral courage are distinct. One can be brave on a whaling ship or a battlefield, yet a coward before human evil. Starbuck elucidates this division. The first mate is tormented by his complicity in what he foresees as Ahab's impious end. Starbuck, while generally abiding firm in the conflict with seas or winds or whales or any of the ordinary irrational horrors of the world, it cannot withstand those more terrific, because spiritual terrors, which sometimes menace you from the concentrating brow of an enraged and mighty man. Mutiny was the only salvation for the Pequod's crew. It is our only salvation, but moral cowardice turns us into hostages. I am reading and rereading the debates among some of the great radical thinkers of the 19th and 20th centuries about the mechanisms of social change. These debates were not academic. They were frantic searches for the triggers of revolt. Lenin placed his faith in a violent uprising. A professional, disciplined, revolutionary vanguard freed from moral constraints, and like Marx, in the inevitable emergence of the workers' state. Proudhon insisted that gradual change would be accomplished as enlightened workers took over production and educated and converted the rest of the proletariat. Bakunin predicted the catastrophic breakdown of the capitalist order, something we are likely to witness in our lifetime, and new autonomous worker federations rising up out of the chaos. Kropotkin, like Proudhon, believed in an evolutionary process that would hammer out a new society. Emma Goldman, along with Kropotkin, came to be very wary both of the efficacy of violence and the revolutionary potential of the masses. The mass, Goldman wrote bitterly toward the end of her life, echoing Marx, clings to its masters, loves the whip, and is the first to cry, crucify. The revolutionists of history counted on a mobilized base of enlightened industrial workers. The building blocks of revolt, they believed, relied on the tool of the general strike, the ability of workers to cripple the mechanisms of production. Strikes could be sustained with the support of political parties, strike funds, and union halls. Workers without these support mechanisms had to replicate the infrastructure of parties and unions if they wanted to put prolonged pressure on the bosses and the state. But now, with the decimation of the U.S. manufacturing base, along with the dismantling of our unions and opposition parties, we will have to search for different instruments of rebellion. We will have to develop a revolutionary theory that is not reliant on the industrial or agrarian muscle of workers. Most manufacturing jobs have disappeared, and of those that remain, few are unionized. Our family farms have been destroyed by agribusinesses. Monsanto and its Faustian counterparts on Wall Street rule. They are steadily poisoning our lives and rendering us powerless. The corporate leviathan, which is global, is freed from the constraints of a single nation state or government. Corporations are beyond regulation or control. Politicians are too anemic, or more often too corrupt, to stand in the way of the accelerating corporate destruction. This makes our struggle different from the revolutionary struggles in industrial societies in the past. Our revolt will look more like what erupted in less industrialized Slavic republics, Russia, Spain, and China, and uprisings led by disenfranchised rural and urban working class and peasantry in the liberation movements that swept through Africa and Latin America. The dispossessed working poor, along with unemployed college students and graduates, unemployed journalists, lawyers, and teachers, along with impoverished artists, will form our movement. And this is why the fight for a higher minimum wage is crucial to uniting service workers with the alienated college-educated sons and daughters of the declining middle class. Bakunin, unlike Marx, considered these déclassé intellectuals essential for successful revolt. It is not the poor who make revolutions. It is those who conclude that they will not be able, as they once expected, to rise economically and socially. Service workers and fast food workers know they are trapped, as does the swelling population of college graduates caught in a vice of low-paying jobs and obscene amounts of debt. These two groups, once united, will be our primary engines of revolt. Much of the urban poor has been crippled and in many cases broken by a rewriting of laws, especially drug laws, that has permitted courts, probation officers, parole boards, and police to randomly seize poor people of color, especially African American men, without just cause and lock them in cages for years. In many of our most impoverished urban centers, our internal colonies, as Malcolm X called them, mobilization will be difficult. The urban poor are in chains, and those chains are being readied for the rest of us. Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan examined 100 years of violent and nonviolent resistant movements in their book, Why Civil Resistance Works. They concluded that nonviolent movements succeed twice as often as violent uprisings. Violent movements work primarily in civil wars or in ending foreign occupations, they found. Nonviolent movements appeal to those within the power structure, especially the police and civil servants, who are cognizant of the corruption and decadence of the power elite and are willing, in the end, to abandon them. And we need only 1 to 5% of the population actively working for the overthrow of a system, history has shown, to bring down even the most ruthless totalitarian structures. Rebellion works on two tracks, building alternative structures, such as public banks, to free ourselves from the control, and finding mechanisms to halt the machine. The most important impediment facing us now is not ideological. It is logistical. The security and surveillance state has made its highest priority the breaking of any infrastructure that might spark widespread unrest or revolt. The state knows the tinder is there. It knows that the continued unraveling of the economy and the effects of climate change make popular unrest inevitable. It knows that as underemployment and unemployment doom at least a quarter of the U.S. population, perhaps more, to perpetual poverty, and as unemployment benefits are scaled back, as schools close, as the middle class withers away, as pension funds are looted by hedge fund thieves, and as the government continues to let the fossil fuel industry ravage the planet, the future will increasingly be one of open conflict. The battle against the corporate state right now is primarily about building an infrastructure to sustain resistance. The state, in its internal projections, has a vision of the future that is as dystopian as mine. But the state, to protect itself, uses its mechanisms of propaganda to assure us that we can continue to build a society based on limitless growth, profligate consumption, and a dependence on fossil fuel. The mania for hope is fed at the expense of truth. The corporate state, meanwhile, is preparing secretly for the world it knows is actually coming. It is cementing into place a pervasive police state, one that includes the complete evisceration of our most basic civil liberties and the militarization of the internal security apparatus, as well as the wholesale surveillance of the citizenry. Those with the moral courage to expose this security and surveillance apparatus, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Jeremy Hammond, are criminalized and persecuted. We will be sustained in our revolt, which will require us to confront all systems of power by the transcendental. Chants, work songs, spirituals, the blues, poetry, dance, and art converged under slavery to nourish and sustain the imagination of African Americans. These were the forces that, as Ralph Ellison wrote, we had in place of freedom. The oppressed would be the first, for they often know their fate, to admit that on a rational level, such a notion is absurd. But they also know that it is only through the imagination that they survive. Jewish inmates in Auschwitz reportedly put God on trial for the Holocaust and then condemned God to death. This is a rational response to the horror of the Holocaust. A rabbi stood after the verdict to lead the evening prayers. This is the absurdity we must capture. African Americans and Native Americans for centuries had little control over their destinies. Forces of bigotry and violence kept them subjugated by whites. Suffering for the oppressed was tangible. Death was a constant companion, and it was only their imagination, as William Faulkner noted at the end of The Sound and the Fury, that permitted them, unlike the novel's white Compson family, to endure. The theologian James Cone captures this in his book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. Cone says that for oppressed blacks, the cross on which Jesus was crucified was a paradoxical religious symbol because it inverts the world's value system with the news that hope comes by way of defeat, that suffering and death do not have the last word, that the last shall be first and the first last. Cone continues, that God could make a way out of no way in Jesus' cross was truly absurd to the intellect, yet profoundly real in the souls of black folk. Enslaved blacks who first heard the gospel message seized on the power of the cross. Christ crucified manifests God's loving and liberating presence in the contradictions of black life, the transcendent presence in the lives of black Christians that empowered them to believe that ultimately, in God's eschatological future, they would not be defeated by the troubles of this world, no matter how great and painful their suffering. Believing this paradox, this absurd claim of faith, was only possible in humility and repentance. There was no place for the proud and the mighty, for people who think that God called them to rule over others. The cross was God's critique of power, white power, with powerless love, snatching victory out of defeat. Reinhold Niebuhr labeled this capacity to defy forces of repression, even in the face of near certain defeat, a sublime madness in the soul. Niebuhr wrote that nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This sublime madness, as Niebuhr understood, is vital. Without it, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also knew that traditional liberalism was a useless force in moments of extremity. Liberalism, Niebuhr said, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an effective force in history. The prophets in the Hebrew Bible spoke out of this sublime madness. The words of the Hebrew prophets, as Abraham Heschel wrote, were a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. The prophet, because he or she saw and faced an unpleasant reality, was, Heschel said, compelled to proclaim the very opposite of what his or her heart expected. Rebellion is a moral imperative. It is to be carried out regardless of the possibilities of success. It is not for the practical or the timid. It is an act that is performed in the end because of, in times of despair and suffering, it affirms life. Primo Levi, in his memoir, Survival in Auschwitz, tells of teaching Italian to another inmate, Jean Samuel, in exchange for lessons in French. Levi recites to Samuel from memory, Canto 26 of Dante's The Inferno. It is the story of Ulysses' final voyage. We cheered, but soon that cheering turned to woe, for then a whirlwind, born from the strange land, battered our little vessel on the prow. Three times the boat and all the sea were whirled, and at the fourth, to please another's will, the aft tipped in the air, the prow went down until the ocean closed above our bones. He has received the message, Levi writes of his friend and what they shared in Dante. He has felt that it has to do with him, that it has to do with all men who toil, and with us in particular. Levy goes on, it is vitally necessary and urgent that he listen, that he understand, before it is too late. Tomorrow he or I might be dead, or we might never see each other again. It is only those who find the courage to peer into the molten pit who can minister to the suffering of those around them. They will be infected with this sublime madness. As Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism, the only morally reliable people are not those who say, this is wrong, or this should not be done, but those who say, I can't. They know that, as Immanuel Kant wrote, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And this means that, like Socrates, we must come to a place where it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong, no matter what happens around us. We can surmount despair, not by ignoring reality, but by responding radically to it. And this includes acts of civil disobedience, including jail time. In these acts, we become fully human. One of the only coherent philosophical positions is revolt, Camus wrote. It is a constant confrontation between man and his obscurity. It is not aspiration, for it is devoid of hope. That revolt is the certainty of a crushing fate without the resignation that ought to accompany it. Those we must follow now will be as ornery and mad as all prophets. They will call us to lives of steadfast defiance. They will be burnt children. The people noticed that Crazy Horse was queerer than ever, Black Elk said, in remembering the final days of the wars of Western expansion. He went on to say of the great Sioux warrior, he hardly ever stayed in the camp. People would find him out alone in the cold, and they would ask him to come home with them. He would not come, but sometimes he would tell the people what to do. People wondered if he ate anything at all. Once my father found him out alone like that, and he said to my father, Uncle, you have noticed me the way I act, but do not worry. There are caves and holes for me to live in, and out here the spirits may help me. I am making plans for the good of my people. Homer, Dante, Beethoven, Melville, Dostoevsky, Proust, Joyce, W.H. Auden, Emily Dickinson, and James Baldwin, along with artists such as the sculptor David Smith, the photographer Diane Arbus, and the blues musician Charlie Patton, all had this sublime madness. It is the sublime madness that lets one sing, as bluesman Ishman Bracey did in Hinds County, Mississippi, I've been down so long, Lord, down don't worry me. And yet, in the midst of imagination also lies the absurdity and certainty of divine justice. I feel my hell arisen every day. I feel my hell arisen every day. Someday it'll burst this levee and wash the whole world away. Shakespeare's greatest heroes and heroines, Prospero, Anthony, Juliet, Rosalind, Hamlet, Cordelia, have this sublime madness. King Lear, once he was stripped of power and forced to live with the persecuted and poor, had it. It was only then that he could see. It was only then that he understood that unbridled human lust and hubris led to the suicide of the species. It will come, Albany says in the play. Humanity must perforce prey on itself like monsters of the deep. The poems of Federico Garcia Lorca sustain the Republicans fighting the fascists in Spain. Music, dance, drama, art, song, painting were the fire and drive of all of history's resistance movements. The rebel units in El Salvador, when I covered the war, always traveled with musicians and theater groups. Art, as Emma Goldman pointed out, has the power to make ideas felt. Goldman noted that when Andrew Undershaft, a character in George Bernard Shaw's play Major Barbara, said poverty is the worst of crimes, and all other crimes are virtues beside it, his impassioned declaration elucidated the cruelty of class warfare more effectively than Shaw's socialist tracts. The degradation of education into vocational training for the corporate state, the destructions of the humanities, arts, and journalism, the hijacking of these disciplines by corporate sponsors, severs the population from understanding, self-actualization, and transcendence. In aesthetic terms, the corporate state seeks to crush beauty, truth, and imagination, and this is the war waged by all totalitarian systems. The role of the artist, then, precisely, is to illuminate that darkness, blaze roads through the vast forest, James Baldwin wrote, so that we will not, in all our doing, lose sight of its purpose, which is, after all, to make the world a more humane dwelling place. Ultimately, the artist and the revolutionary function as they function and pay whatever dues they must pay behind it, because they are both possessed by a vision that they do not so much follow this vision as find themselves driven by it, Baldwin wrote. Otherwise, they could never endure, much less embrace, the lives they are compelled to lead. I do not know if we can build a better society. I do not even know if we will survive as a species. But I know these corporate forces have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. And this is a fight which, in the face of the overwhelming forces arrayed against us, requires us to embrace sublime madness, to find in acts of rebellion the embers of life, an intrinsic meaning that lies outside the certainty of success. We must at once grasp our reality and then refuse to allow reality to paralyze us. We must make an absurd leap of faith. We must believe, despite the empirical evidence around us, that the good always draws to it the good. We do not know where acts of goodness go. The Buddhists call it karma. But in these acts, we make visible a better world. It is time for our own mutiny, for the overthrow of our own Ahabs, for the redirecting of our ship away from certain death back towards life. No matter how bleak things get, we always have a choice in life. We can choose to be rebels or slaves, and that choice is one the corporate state is powerless to take from us. And to rebel, even if we fail, is to succeed. We must become a threat to the security and surveillance state and its corporate overlords, and we cannot become a threat if we do not engage in actions that actively obstruct power. The Turkish poet Nazım Hikmet, who spent most of his adult life in prison or in exile, knew something of despair, but he knew something too of resistance, of that rebellious spirit which must define us in times of oppression if we are to remain fully human. Any act of resistance, large or small, he wrote from inside his prison cell, is its own eternal triumph. Any act of resistance lights up the night sky to remind us why we were created. Hikmet captured this in his poem on living. Living is no laughing matter. You must live with great seriousness, like a squirrel, for example, I mean without looking for something beyond and above living. I mean living must be your whole occupation. Living is no laughing matter. You must take it seriously, so much so, and to such a degree that, for example, your hands tied behind your back, your back to the wall, or else in a laboratory in your white coat and safety glasses, you can die for people, even for people whose faces you've never seen. Even though you know living is the most real, the most beautiful thing. I mean, you must take living so seriously that even at 70, for example, you'll plant olive trees, and not for your children either. But because although you fear death, you don't believe it, because living, I mean, weighs heavier. Let's say we're seriously ill, need surgery, which is to say we might not get up from the white table. Even though it's impossible not to feel sad about going a little too soon, we'll still laugh at the jokes being told. We'll look out the window to see if it's raining, or still wait anxiously for the latest newscast. Let's say we're at the front for something worth fighting for, say. There, in the first offensive on that very day, we might fall on our face, dead. We'll know this with a curious anger, but we'll still worry ourselves to death about the outcome of the war, which could last years. Let's say we're in prison and close to 50, and we have 18 more years, say, before the iron doors will open. We'll still live with the outside, with its people and animals, struggle and wind. I mean with the outside beyond the walls. I mean however and wherever we are, we must live as if we will never die. This earth will grow cold, a star among stars and one of the smallest, a gilded mote on blue velvet. I mean this, our great earth. This earth will grow cold one day, not like a block of ice or a dead cloud even, but like an empty walnut, it will roll along in pitch black space. You must grieve for this right now. You have to feel this sorrow now, for the world must be loved this much if you're going to say, I lived. Thank you.
We can change it anytime we want. Only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one.
I'm going to share with you a vision that I had because I love you and you feel it. You know all that money we spend on nuclear weapons and defense every year, trillions of dollars, correct? Instead, just play with this. If we spent that money feeding and clothing the poor of the world, and it would pay for it many times over, not one human being excluded.
Then we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever. In peace. Thank you very much. You've been great. I hope you enjoyed it.
And I felt I needed to give us a quick shot of Bill Hicks there, whom we last heard too long ago. 592 was the last episode we had a Bill Hicks vibe, because he looks the real world straight in the eye. How long can the Treasury go on making 85 trillion imaginary bits of paper on computer and doing something with them? As long as anybody wants them to, because that is not the real world, that's numbers. And yes, if you emotionally attach importance to those numbers, well then you run out of emotions at some stage, because the numbers you can just add as many noughts on as you can type on the computer. But if you're attaching that much importance to some sort of abstractions from the real world, then where does loving the real world fit into this? Am I worried about the economy imploding? No, because what is the economy? It's a fiction. The reason why it's discussed endlessly in the commercially controlled media is precisely because it's not important. It's a distraction from what's really going on. The goal of increasing the total monetary value of goods and services reported to the government for tax purposes in a particular area regardless of the impact on the real world, is an insane end, if ever I heard one. Am I concerned about the possibility of a lot of people who've been trained that food comes out of supermarkets suddenly finding there are no supermarkets with any food left in them? Yes, that's a big possibility that I want to try and avoid. What about people travelling around with guns, using them to scare other people out of their house? Well, I think about half the US foreclosed homes are still actually being occupied, but there's certainly a real risk that the banksters are going to be turning out ever more people onto the streets at gunpoint. Trying to live in a world where these things don't happen is a worthy end, as I see it. A world of abundance of the kind painted by Bill Hicks, where people don't feel a lack of nuclear weapons, where security comes not from having locks on doors and bigger guns to point at the neighbours, but a world in which we see that we're all one. That, to me, is a sane end and a healthy end. But, as I see it, anything to do with the money, economy, sustainability, trying to sustain the current world view of extreme separation, appears to me to be an insane end. Trying to argue it logically, looking at small pieces of the system, whether it's rates of insurance, income tax, anything inside the moneyed world, to me, smacks of insanity. I feel a higher calling to love this world, not a mathematical abstraction of it. Now, I thought we should close the show with another great pioneer. This is from episode 123, Lynn Gerry responding to a listener who seems to have been overexposed to commercially controlled media and all that that entails.
I'd like to conclude the program by taking a moment to address some listener comments we've received following last week's broadcast of a speech by Dr. Michael Parenti. WEOS got a couple of calls from listeners angered by the speech. I didn't speak to the callers myself, so I'm responding based on what was reported to me. What was most interesting was one caller's demand that views such as Dr. Parenti's not be broadcast on the grounds that they were anti-American, a censorious position many would consider anti-American in itself. Michael Parenti is American, as is G.W. Bush, as is the angry caller, as am I. The argument that a position is or isn't anti-American is pretty meaningless to me, but if being American has any value to me, it means that I have the ability to advocate for and struggle to achieve the type of society to which I can consent. I don't consent to being governed by this present system. I am forced to submit to this government by a network of coercion that threatens my life and liberty. I think calls such as the station received support the substance of Dr. Parenti's analysis, that there are two concurrent threads in American culture that are mutually antagonistic. One is that of popular struggle to expand democracy in order to distribute the blessings of liberty and prosperity to widening circles among the people. The other is that of totalitarian empire, based on taking from others through force in an ongoing orgy of violence and greed, and constricting liberty only to those who have prosperity. This latter current is exemplified by the present so-called leadership of this nation. Though it has been a perpetual feature of the government, which has always followed John Jay's dictum, that those who own the country ought to run it. I invite those objecting to Dr. Parenti's analysis of American political history to submit evidence demonstrating any false statements or errors in his speech. I will be happy to present them here, unlike the corporate media and NPR propaganda machines that won't give dissenting views a fair hearing. The station manager of WEOS told me he explained to callers that the station airs a variety of perspectives. One caller suggested that the station be more selective in the variety of perspectives it airs. I'd like to assure listeners that the producers of this program, which is the only group I can speak for, are indeed selective. While we're not in absolute agreement with every voice we present, we only present material we think contains ideas worth the attention of our listeners. In the case of Dr. Parenti, I would like to categorically state that I am in full agreement with his analysis and condemnation of American empire, the failure of capitalism, and its fundamental incompatibility with democracy. As I said in the introduction last week, I believe we are at a time of particular crisis in America. George W. Bush has repeatedly referred to a variety of other countries as part of an axis of evil. I know that many people are uncomfortable using the term evil when discussing political issues, as it seems too supernatural, but I have no problem with the term. To me, it seems a fitting description of people who would blithely kill, maim, and immiserate unlimited numbers of other people in order to gain wealth, power, or prestige. And this description of evil fits the Bush administration and the people behind him who have planned the policies now being carried out in my name and with my money, as much as it fits Saddam Hussein, the Taliban, or any other tyrants. But because I am an American, G.W. Bush and his friends have made me an unwilling accomplice in their murderous greed. And if a variety of other nations have evil leaders, a great deal of responsibility for that rests with the American empire, which has fostered and foisted brutal dictators on many unfortunate people all over this world, including Iraq and Afghanistan. The people of those nations, most of them fundamentally decent folk, such as we ourselves are, have been made to suffer twice. First under their brutal leaders, then under horrific bombs dropped in my name and built with my taxes. The issue for me is not whether something is or isn't anti-American. My concern is with presenting ideas and analysis that will assist in creating the sort of society that I want to live in, which at the present time exists nowhere on this earth. Very frequently, the people who become enraged by criticism of the U.S. government, particularly when it comes to the war-making of that government, tell critics such as myself that we should either love it or leave it. Those of us who feel the way I feel, and we are many, though our voices are seldom heard, have just as much right to be here as anyone else. Let me therefore make a modest proposal to the war-loving fans of empire. Let us divide the U.S. in half, and let us each have our own country. You can keep the system you so prize that will have you working 40 hours a week or more at a meaningless job you hate, for the privilege of filling your gas-guzzling car with fuel to drive through a landscape littered with Walmarts and McDonald's where fields of flowers once grew. You may fight and die to your heart's content for the privilege of living for the weekend and paying out chunks of that hard-earned paycheck to a government so that it can build weapons and employ armies and cops to make sure that you don't kick up a fuss should your masters deem you superfluous and uncompetitive. So that you won't come against them with the outrage they deserve, but will resign yourself quietly to a bed in the doorway of a dirty street, where your fellow proud citizens will drive their shiny new cars by your prostrate body as if you were just another hunk of garbage. If that's the country you want, be my guest. In our America, no one will work 40 hours a week unless they want to, because they so love the work they do, or a matter of life and death demands attention. The jobs that are too stupid, boring, or dangerous for people, we will build machines to do, because technology will serve us rather than compete with us. We'll all enjoy the leisure that this gives us to pursue activities that we do like. We probably won't have too many overnight delivery services in our country because the phrase, time is money, will never be spoken. In our America, we'll understand that time is priceless, as it reflects the minutes of our precious lives, lives which each of us deserves to have filled with love, beauty, and a sense of dignity. We won't have too many fast food restaurants, because we won't have to be in such a rush to conform to someone else's regimentation of the hours of our lives in order to be more efficient tools to produce profit for them. We will sit down to delicious meals, free of poisons, and take as long as we like to savor them in the company of loved ones. We won't fear cold or darkness because the power of the sun and the wind will light our way, and no one will have to pay, kill, or go without. It will be an entitlement of citizenship. We'll have many doctors, engineers, craftspeople, and artists. No one will be stopped from pursuing an education for lack of money or feel compelled to study something they don't like just to be able to get a job after graduation. We probably won't have too many stockbrokers, bankers, prison guards, or cops. We won't need them. We will give to all our citizens with open hands, and what we will receive in return is the pleasure of living in a community of capable and self-respecting neighbors on whom we can rely. We won't compete with each other, at least not about anything more serious than a sports match or a pie-baking contest. We'll cooperate, and thus not waste time in the production of useless items that are all the same anyway. We will spend lots of time making decisions about how we want things to go in our country, and will take as long as necessary for everyone who wants to speak to be heard from and participate. Those among us who lead in various things will be those we most admire, instead of those who are the most vicious, corrupt, or adept at kowtowing to the powerful. We won't pledge allegiance to a flag, under or not under God. We will have noted that mandatory words are usually an indication of the falsity of the statement. It won't be necessary to indoctrinate small children into believing that they live in a country with liberty and justice for all. It will be obvious in their daily lives. Our America will still have unpleasant tasks. There will always be garbage and plugged toilets. But we will divide these chores equally. And because no one of us is stuck spending all their time doing them, we'll do them with as much good cheer as we can. We won't have much of an army because we won't go around the world stealing from others and making enemies. Probably our greatest threat will come from your America, that will consider our country to be setting a bad example and encouraging insubordination against the wealthy rulers of your country. They have done this so many times before. Our worst problem will be how to make room for all the immigrants that will flock to our open borders. You, caller, might even be one of them.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end.
This and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you'd like to contact me, I'm unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
The rich will come down like an